welcome to the political cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Your host for tonight is your host every night. Yes, indeed, it is me, James Edwards. Welcome back to the Political Cesspool radio program. I hope you had a great week in between our live appearances here every Saturday night. And it just so happens that this Saturday night is May the 29th, and it's good to be back with you, as always, from AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee, going out to our AM-FM affiliate stations on the Liberty News Radio Network. If you're tuned in on the Internet, you're at thepoliticalcesspool.org or libertynewsradio.com. And don't forget, if you can't catch our live program through all of those venues, the broadcast archives are available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on demand, immediately following our live show. We go off at 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock in 1 second, those archives are ready for you at thepoliticalcesspool.org. Got a big show lined up for you this evening, a couple of great guests, a couple of regular guests on the show tonight. During the second hour, Dr. Virginia Abernethy, Professor Emeritus at Vanderbilt University, is going to be on to talk about her signature issue, which is immigration, and that just happens to be an issue we're making a great many strides on. Coming up in the third hour, Tom Ball, author of Starving the Monkeys. He was on for a very celebrated show 2 weeks ago, got a lot of good feedback from you, our fans and the listening audience, from his appearance a couple of weeks ago. He's back on tonight to talk about homeschooling. He was on 2 weeks ago to talk about economics. He's an author. He's an expert on everything. Tonight we're going to be talking about a course that he has created pertaining to homeschooling. So Virginia Abernethy and Tom Ball forthcoming tonight. But first, of course, this hour is the hour in which Keith Alexander joins me each week. Keith, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I've had a great week and looking forward to spending a relaxing Memorial Day with my family and going out to the local Veterans Cemetery and commemorating those that have fought and fallen in previous wars for America, unlike our president.
Yeah, I saw that. He's going on a little family vacation this week, right?
Yep. I tell you what, you can tell where his priorities are. Exactly. Apparently he doesn't take that role as commander-in-chief too seriously.
I didn't expect him to see him at the Confederate cemetery, but I figured he might go to Arlington, but no such luck. Nevertheless, Keith, I could probably tell you another person that's not going to be at Arlington Cemetery celebrating anything pro-American, and that is Obama's latest Supreme Court nominee, Elena Kagan. Made big news a couple of weeks ago when he first nominated her. Hasn't quite been in the news as much lately, although here in the political cesspool, we keep our eyes on everything. It's just one of the reasons why the political cesspool has been on fire this year. And we want to talk now about Elena Kagan's judicial hero. And as we wrote on the blog, we ask you to imagine who Elena Kagan's judicial hero is. It's not any of the usual suspects you might think it would be, Earl Warren, John Paul Stevens, Harry Blackmun, any of those guys. No, not even close, Keith. Her American hero, judicial hero, I should say, isn't even an American. It's a Jewish fellow on Israel's Supreme Court, and his name is Aaron Barak. Well, what did you expect? And he takes judicial activism to a whole nother level. Robert Bork said that Aaron Barak, who apparently Elena Kagan is going to be modeling her judicial activism after, Robert Bork says he establishes a whole world record for judicial hubris. And this is the same, of course, Elena Kagan that the conservative, now he's a conservative, you know, Dick Morris calls a moderate, but of course, like Kagan, Morris is Jewish, and he doesn't have a problem telling flat-out lies to help a member of his tribe. And life, Keith, as we know it, is going to be very different if we continue to pack the Supreme Court with Puerto Ricans, other non-whites, and radical Zionists like Kagan. But what do you know about Aaron Barak, Keith, Kagan's judicial hero?
Well, there must be something about that name Barak, James, that she likes. But, well, look, let's make it as simple as we can for people. Whenever you appoint a Jewish person to high office in America, you can rest assured that they're not only going to be a liberal, but they're going to be an extreme left liberal activist. You know, I've gone back with you and we've looked at every Jewish judge appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court beginning in 1916 with Louis Brandeis and going forward to Elena Kagan, every last one of them was not just only a liberal. It's assured they're going to be a liberal, but they're furthermore liberal activists. You know, judicial scholars like to try to portray Judge Felix Frankfurter as some type of model of judicial restraint. But, you know, we've already gone over his shenanigans in forcing the court into his decision on Brown versus Board of Education. If that's a model of judicial restraint, please tell me, pray tell, what is an example of judicial activism? This guy was off the chart, and every last one of these Jewish judges is going to be off the chart. Now, if you, in liberalism, if you're a conservative, that should really concern you, James.
Well, it does concern me, Keith. And, of course, you know, we've been talking this month about Brown versus Board of Education, as we do every May around the date of its anniversary. You did, I think it was 2 weeks ago, just such an excellent commentary and analysis on that. And certainly, Elena Kagan not only follows the type of judicial activism that was prevalent in Brown, but she takes it to a whole other level, especially if she's modeling her career or planning to model her career after Aaron Barak.
Well, what she is basically is a red diaper baby. She came from the same neighborhood that produced Andrew Goodman, the so-called civil rights martyr. I would call him a Budinsky instead of the Mississippi burning story. In fact, one of our listeners named Kim sent us an email this week telling us how the father of a friend encountered Goodman at a cocktail party in Manhattan before he went down first to the Highlander Folk School to learn how to wage culture war, and then to Mississippi, where he was bragging about how he's going to stir up things for civil rights. And this friend's father warned him about going down there and stirring things up. Of course, he didn't heed the advice, and the rest is history.
And this, of course, was back in the 60s.
Right. This was back in the 1960s, 63 or 4. I think 64 is when the Mississippi burning murders happened. But nonetheless, you know, let's think about, you know, this red diaper baby phenomenon. A lot of people aren't familiar with that term. It refers to people whose parents were card-carrying members of the Communist Party or fellow travelers who raised their children to be left-wing social revolutionaries. They would send them to communist summer camp at places like Camp Willowan, the Catskills. They would send them to schools like the Little Red Schoolhouse for Little Reds at 6th Avenue and Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, or the Elizabeth I. Irwin High School, where they taught Soviet history and not American history. And they, you know, these people were programmed to be social revolutionaries. These aren't clean-scrubbed little folk-singing aficionados that were just inspired by John F. Kennedy's New Frontier. This is the background that Kagan comes from. It said in an article that we read that nobody in the Upper West Side, where she hails from, would ever admit to voting Republican for president. Now, you know, I don't think people know what an extreme left-wing surprise package we have here in Kagan, but we're aware of it here at the Cesspool, James.
Well, we're aware of a lot of things here in the Cesspool, and I think that knowledge is one of the things that separates us from our peers, and much more than that, our willingness to share that knowledge in a frank and candid manner is what's made us so successful. And we're going to continue to talk about it. Wherever threats to our people exist, you can expect to hear about it on the radio program, and much more than making you informed, we do our best to give you solutions that you can apply in your daily life and your activism to help us sort of turn this thing around. And then we're going to continue to talk about it. We're going to talk about all the issues, and we're going to try to do it as succinctly as we can and as professionally as we can. And Keith, that's, in a nutshell, I guess, our modus operandi.
Okay.
Well, I know we're coming up on a break here, but I do want to take just a brief moment before we head into the words from our sponsors and into the second segment as this program kicks off this evening. Next week, in fact, less than a week, June 4th and 5th, we will be right here in Tennessee, as a matter of fact, at the Council of Conservative Citizens National Conference. If you remember last year, we had an absolutely outstanding live remote broadcast in front of a live studio audience right there. I think it was in Jackson, Mississippi last year at the CFCC 2009 National Conference. Well, the time is upon us once again. And next week, June 4th and 5th, you can join me. You can meet me, and I think Keith is going to be there for a little while, as well as so many other successful stars at the CFCC meeting. I'm going to give you more information about that and let you know how to register right after this. Stay tuned, everybody.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, everybody. Another live broadcast of the political cesspool is moving forward here this Saturday evening, May the 29th. Before that last break, I was telling you that as host of this award-winning broadcast, I'm afforded a few opportunities each year to deliver public speeches that allow me to meet our fans face-to-face, and I will be making my annual stop at the 2010 Council of Conservative Citizens National Conference next weekend right here in Tennessee, and I certainly hope that you're going to have the opportunity to be there with us. It's going to be taking place next Friday and Saturday, June 4th and 5th, so if you haven't made plans to come up to Tennessee and be a part of this yet, there is still time. There are still, I think, a couple of hotel rooms still available at the beautiful facilities that they've reserved for this year's conference. It's going to have a luncheon, which features Jared Taylor of American Renaissance as the speaker. I will be there giving a talk, as will Derek Black, Dr. Tomislav Sunik, Paul Fromm, Sam Dixon, all of these people, very good friends, and previously featured guest on our show, plus more, 18 speakers in all, again, including yours truly. So if you want to come up to Tennessee, you want to be a part of this, there's going to be 200, 300 people there, good people, good conservative, red-blooded, tax-paying American citizens. You're going to feel right at home. To register, you need to call the Council of Conservative Citizens National Headquarters, and that number is 636-940-8474. 636-940-8474 to register for next weekend's National Conference of the Council of Conservative Citizens. We'll talk more about that later in the show. But first, back to Keith Alexander with a little bit more on the story we were covering in the first segment, Alanna Kagan, Judicial Activism, Brown versus Board of Education. Keith, where do we go next?
Well, you know, this is our last show in May, and every May we make it a point to memorialize or mourn, as you know, take it as you like it, the Brown versus Board of Education decision, because it was such a cataclysmic change in American life that it wrought upon Americans, and because it was a watershed moment. It was a moment, basically, when the left learned how to govern America without winning elections or persuading legislators. Now, Brown did several things. First of all, it integrated the public schools, and it has brought about an unprecedented drop in the quality of American public education. In 1954, American public education was at the top of the developed world, and now American public education is at the bottom of quality education for the developed world, James. And this was a cataclysmic change to Americans back in 1954. If you will recall, Brown overruled an earlier precedent, Plessy versus Ferguson, that said that segregation was not in violation of the 14th Amendment so long as the facilities provided for the races were separate and but equal. Now, that's a 62-year precedent. Brown is now a 56-year-old precedent. Imagine how cataclysmic it would be if the Supreme Court tomorrow rendered a decision overruling Brown and reaffirming Plessy versus Ferguson. Liberals everywhere would be going nuts. Well, conservatives everywhere were going nuts back in 54. What has been the effect besides this great change? First of all, it integrated the public schools. And what it did was, first of all, cause a great decline in the quality of public education offered to people that had to rely on the public schools, and at least in a place like Memphis, for the most part, that was the minority population. For the white population, it has thrust on them an ever-increasing burden to provide either private school education, which is a financial burden, or homeschooling, which is a time, effort, and energy burden, on the white middle class. It led to white flight and private schools. Just think, James, of the trillions of dollars that have been spent on private school education by the white population, particularly the white middle class, in order to get the same type of education that was previously available for free before the Brown decision. Now, this has led to disruption of housing patterns and the racial composition of cities as well. And it's led to the impoverishment of the middle class in America. One of the things that the left wants to do, I am convinced, is squeeze the middle class out of existence in America. And really the first step by increasing their financial burden so they had no wealth to pass on to their children is the Brown decision. Now, the other thing that it did, besides, you know, it allowed tyrannical non-representative government to hold sway. It was the moment where basically the left learned how to rule without the consent of the governed. Justice Stanley Reed, one of the judges who was one of the last holdouts to Frankfurter's pressure in the Brown decision, said that what they were proposing was in effect a critarchy, which is an obscure word that means an oligarchy of judges. Unelected federal judges, and that's what Supreme Court judges are, they're unelected, unaccountable to the electorate, now have the final say on how the public schools are run. And in traditional American political thought, if there was one area of political life that was considered the exclusive province of local government, it was public education. And of course, that was all destroyed, turned over with a stroke of a pen by the Brown decision. It was a cultural Marxist coup d'etat, James. Now, the other thing that it did was to usher in the age of the magic lawsuit. Just like the song Puff the Magic Dragon, they ought to make a version of it called Brown the Magic Lawsuit. Leftists were drawn to law schools after the Brown decision in order to change the world. That's not the standard and ordinary motive for going to law school, and it has caused untold mischief in American life. It's resulted in a sea change in the legal system, and I think the changes in the legal system since 1954 are to be mourned rather than to be celebrated. And also, it led to a new age of federal supremacy. No limits on federal power due to the intentionally dishonest reading of the Interstate Commerce Clause upon which the Brown decision was based. Public education was, before 1954, the quintessential province of local government. This represented a total reordering of priorities. And this is why people in the South and in the Midwest and in virtually any area of the country in which there was a substantial population of minority people were alarmed, and rightfully so, when this decision was handed down. You know, the analysis that we're giving is something that you're just not going to find anywhere else. You know, basically, we're unique. What is said here won't be heard anywhere else. We tell the truth without fear or favor. We say, like Admiral Farragut at Mobile Bay, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Basically, George Orwell said, he who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past. That's what we have. We have the left telling us that Brown was a good thing when all the evidence is that it was a horrible thing for America, James.
Keith, hold it right there. I hear music. We'll be back right after this.
Political cesspool, guys. We'll be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, keep in mind we are just getting started tonight. Forthcoming this evening, Dr. Virginia Abernathy on immigration during tonight's second hour, Tom Ball, author of Starving the Monkeys and columnist for Liberty News Radio, will be with us the third hour to talk about homeschooling. Still much more to come this first hour also. We're going to be talking about the rampant hypocrisy of leftist attack organizations such as the ADL, and we're also going to talk about how a teacher with 6 years' experience and an unblemished record was forced into the unemployment line because of political correctness. That is all coming up very quickly. But first, turning it back over to Keith for just one or two more minutes on the topic he was so eloquently laying out for you just a couple of minutes ago. Keith?
Well, we were talking about the Brown decision, Brown versus Board of Education, and how it was the beginning of a continuous pattern of squeeze plays inflicted upon the middle class in America. They knew that if they integrated the schools, that white parents would either have to move out of school districts where there was a majority of minorities, or they were going to have to bite the bullet and pay for private school, which gets increasingly more expensive every year, I can tell you as a parent that sent his children to private schools. Also, people that don't send their kids to private schools usually have to move once, twice, sometimes even three times during the course of their children's education, pre-college education, because either the local school board redraws boundary lines for attendance to particular schools, or one area falls to, an incursion of non-whites, which means that the quality of the school goes down and violence goes up. So, see, that's a great engine for impoverishing the middle class. This is a technique that the left uses. For example, in this cap-and-trade legislation that is on the horizon, what they intend to do is eventually do away with most of the hydrogen-based, carbon-based energy that we use. That's petroleum and coal. Well, petroleum and coal is used for 51% of the utilities that we have in America. I know here in Memphis, it's 100%. And it's awfully safe. It's good. It doesn't pollute. I don't come out, neither does James, and find coal dust on our cars in the morning. But they're going to do away with most of what we use for power for our homes and utilities and our cars. And there's nothing effective to replace it with. We're going to have landscapes that are polluted with these endless windmills that T. Boone Pickens and other opportunists are ready to provide. But they're not going to be reliable as far as generating power. So you're going to have to pay more and more. People that make under $55,000 a year are going to basically get it free, which means that everybody that makes over $55,000 a year is going to be paying not only for their utilities, but for the other. Again, the great squeeze play on the middle class. The intention of the left, people like Elena Kagan and all of these other extreme leftists, is to squeeze the middle class out of existence. Don't ever forget it, James.
Well, Well, Keith, you're talking about their intentions. Let's shift gears here for a moment, if we can, and talk about their hypocrisy. The hypocrisy and double standards of the left is something that we talk about quite a bit. But before we get into one example that absolutely had my jaw on the floor, let's set the stage for that story. And we'll set it by reminding you that it is no secret that the ADL and the SPLC hate us and the work that we do on this radio program. For 6 years, this paleoconservative broadcast has been attacked more by these two groups than any other right-of-center entity in the world. And that's without question. The political cesspool has been attacked more by the ADL and the SPLC over the course of the past 5 or 6 years than any other conservative organization in existence today. Why do they hate us so much? I think the answer to that is quite simple. We're white, we're Christian, we're conservative heterosexuals who are proud of our Southern heritage. That, to them, is pure evil. But why, though, still do they attack us so often? Well, I think it's because we don't apologize, first of all, for anything in that list, and we've been fairly successful, to say the least, in using radio to articulate our traditional viewpoints on certain political issues that they'd rather not have us talking about, and we've served as a bridge to the mainstream, and we have won a very large audience. But as I mentioned, another thing we do on this show is that we expose the egregious double standards and hypocrisies that reign inside the halls of these leftist attack organizations. You know, for example, how it's perfectly natural and healthy for blacks, Hispanics, homosexuals, and Jewish individuals to belong to organizations that seek to promote their interests, but it's racist hate for groups that seek to preserve and protect Western civilization to even exist. Stuff like that, for example. And while here in the political cesspool we usually just choose to mock such childish behavior and name-calling, sometimes their hypocrisy knows no bounds whatsoever and leaves me absolutely stunned. And we've written about this story on the blog. If you go to our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org, you can read along for yourself. I was absolutely shocked to read on the ADL's website yesterday a press release that they had issued on Thursday pertaining to Newt Gingrich. And here's what it said. Reading directly from the ADL's press release issued May 27th, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich today assured the Anti-Defamation League that he recognizes the horror and evil of the Nazi regime and did not intend the comparison between Nazis and Democratic leaders in his new book to be a statement of moral equivalence. I now quote ADL Director Abe Foxman when he says, "We welcome Newt Gingrich's efforts to clarify his remarks in the book and on his book tour." Here's the part where the plot thickens, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to what Abe Foxman, ADL National Director, said next. And I quote, "As we have said many times before, Nazi comparisons are inappropriate and have no place in the American political discourse." Let me read that one more time. That is the leader of the Anti-Defamation League saying that comparing people to Nazis have no place in American political discourse. Keith, they have. If I used all my fingers and toes and all of your fingers and toes and all of the fingers and toes of Eddie and Winston and Bill, I would still not have enough digits to count the number of times the ADL has called us Nazis. And that is just us. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of the ADL and similar organizations denouncing conservative activists as Nazis. And for the record, and it probably can go without saying, that's certainly not what we are. They use these Marxist constructs, these shut-up words like Nazi and racist and anti-Semite to try to cower people into silence. But, you know, that game just doesn't work for us.
Well, James,
but the point is, the ADL says comparing people to Nazis has no place in American political discourse, but I can give you 100 examples off the top of my head in which they have denounced people like Pastor Ted Pike and so many others as Nazis. So I guess the hypocrisy here is they put this prominently on their own website saying that this is out of bounds. And, of course, I went and put on our blog a handful of examples in which they've called us the same thing. So in a nutshell, it's inappropriate for Newt Gingrich to compare people to Nazis, but it's more than okay for the ADL to label conservative white Christians like us the same thing.
Well,
Keith, that,
I've
to me,
it out, James.
Is amazing. It doesn't get any more hypocritical than that.
Well, James, I've figured it out.
Well, what is it? Please tell me, because I haven't.
The word Nazis, like the word Jews, can only be used legitimately by Jewish people when they're describing someone else. No one can use, not only can they not describe a Jewish organization like the ADL or a covert Jewish organization like the ACLU as Nazis or having Nazi tactics. They can't even use the word. And, you know, it's like, remember what George Orwell said back in the 1930s about the term fascist? He said that the term fascist has been used so much by the left that he had come to conclude that when a leftist says that Jones is a fascist, basically all he's saying is, I don't like Jones. Well, whenever Abe Foxman, the ADL, calls anyone a Nazi, all they're telling you is that they don't like the person they're talking to.
Well, we will pick up on that very subject when we come back.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the Political Cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, everybody. In that last segment before the commercial break, I was trying to share with you something so bizarre, you might think I'm exaggerating. But if you are, go to our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org, and you can follow a link right over to the ADL's on-press release. It probably seemed something so fantastic that I would have to be infusing a little bit of an exaggeration for you to believe me when I say that the ADL actually said comparing people to Nazis has no place in American political discourse, when the ADL has amassed hundreds of millions of dollars by marketing a fear campaign, which is based upon them creating Nazis and racists and anti-Semite boogeymen from conservative political activists. I mean, Ted Pike is a Nazi, James Dobson is a Nazi, Pat Buchanan's a Nazi, I'm a Nazi. Anybody to the right of Joseph Stalin is a Nazi, according to the ADL. But they have the audacity to be holier than thou and say that when Newt Gingrich compares Barack Obama to a Nazi, that has no place in American politics. Keith, I mean, I'm telling you, if that isn't hypocrisy, if that isn't a textbook definition of hypocrisy, there is no such thing.
Well, any use of the word Nazi needs to be cleared first by Abe Foxman, apparently. And if you don't go to that trouble, then you're going to run afoul and draw his ire. And then they really want to put you down. They call you a neo-Nazi, which I've always thought is the most curious construct of all, you know. Where are these old school Nazis? I guess somewhere down in Paraguay or Uruguay or something, there's a bunch of guys strutting around in Nazi uniforms, saying Heil Hitler and stuff. But you know, this is the strangest, you know, template of all. And another one of their templates, James, that I think I need to comment on before we pass. Whenever they describe the political cesspool, they take pains to say a Tennessee-based AM radio show. In other words, we're down here in Hickville, in Hickhaven. We're probably passing around a jug of corn squeezins here during the show. And, of course, how can you expect anything good or anything of intellectual quality to come from such a backwater as Tennessee? It's just like, you know, that basically that Jewish construct, that template applies to the whole United States. That's why Jewish intellectuals don't have any respect for our Constitution or our founding fathers, because the people that came up with the Constitution and the founding fathers, none of them were Jewish. And, of course, if they're not Jewish, how can these witless goyim come up with anything worthwhile? Of course, you know, the best thing we can do is just play a little lip service to it and then chunk it over our shoulders. That's the way they look at the Constitution, James.
Well, that is, Keith, and, you know, we can't make these people be honest. We can't make these people give us a fair assessment of our character and label us as we are, as paleoconservatives, as Christians, as white political activists, you know, pro-European American. Yeah, we can't help that they call us all of these names that aren't applicable. And I quit worrying about that years and years and years ago, and it doesn't really bother me because they're liars and they're thieves and they're criminally corrupt. But for them to put on their website that this has no place, and then they go right back and do it themselves, is a little bit overboard. Even
they've apparently got the word Nazi trademark.
But we're going to move on from that. It is something you need to check out, though. So go to thepoliticalcesspool.org and don't believe me. Believe your lying eyes.
Well, see, we now understand, James. Abe Foxman has the word Nazi trademarked. Okay?
Yeah, well, sure.
Along with the word Jew.
That's right. Yeah, and Holocaust. Sure, all of them.
Right.
But, all right, one last thing. I've got an example of a teacher who has learned her lesson in Georgia, North Georgia, the story reads. I'm assuming probably Atlanta. And a film school teacher, a high school film teacher, allowed a group of students to make a film that denounces racism. A group of white high school students in Georgia decided to make a film that traces the history of racism in America and how racism has been so bad. And in making this film that, again, denounces racism and traces the history of so-called racism, a few of these students who, again, are in film school, so they're going to be playing characters, right? Apparently, a few of them donned mock KKK outfits for this project that denounces racism. Well, even though they were making a politically correct film as an assignment in school, and in order to make it authentic, they dressed the part. Just the sight of these students in robes upset some of the fellow black classmates at the school and led to one parent complaining. One parent complained that these students wore outfits in their film that denounced racism. And now a teacher, a veteran teacher with 6 years of experience and an unblemished record, she was teaching the advanced placement course combining U.S. history with film education, faces termination. Termination. She faces.
They're going to kill her, James?
Because one parent complained because one black kid got upset because someone dressed up as a Klansman in a film, an advanced placement film denouncing racism. So if this teacher is able to survive the guillotine and she isn't fired, I think a good idea for next year's project, assuming she still has a job, would be to have her students make a film about the hatred of white people by non-whites in America, a hatred that runs so deep that a white teacher can get fired because her students made a film that denounces racism. Keith, again, this is some pretty dangerous stuff.
Well, I tell you what, James, I guess she hadn't learned the lesson. You know, everybody that has listened to this show tonight knows, which is she should have gotten an okay from Abe Foxman first. Before she did this, if she'd done that one little thing, if she had just recognized Abe Foxman as the king of the world and the moderator of all political discourse in America, then she wouldn't have made this egregious error. You know, the thing, and I'm really kind of scared for when you use the term termination. You know, the way the left uses that term, all those allegories you were using might be what they actually have in mind for. You know, And the irony of all this, James, is that she is probably a good card-carrying liberal who has run afoul of political correctness. You know, they say that revolutions always devour their young. You know, Bolsheviks killed fellow Bolsheviks in Russia before they started killing non-Bolsheviks. and likewise in China, likewise in Cambodia under Pol Pot. Well, this is what is happening. See, even that the fact that you're a good card-carrying liberal is not a defense to a crime against political correctness. And, you know, she's probably also automatically suspect because she lives in red state America, you know, that vast flyover area populated by goyim boobs. Like, I remember when Jerry Lewis, the comedian, during the Civil Rights Movement said on television, national television, that whenever he flew from coast to coast, he always wanted to know when he was flying over Mississippi so he could be sure to use the bathroom at that time. Well, see, that's the way the left and the Jewish elite on both coasts think about red state America. So this red state America, dutifully trying to be a good liberal, ran afoul of politically correct etiquette, and now she's toast. Her career is gone, but, you know, we'll all have to just chalk this one up to experience. Remember, the rule is check with Abe Foxman first.
Well, I mean, it wasn't like she was allowing these students to practice their freedom of speech on a controversial matter. I mean, she was just allowing them to tote the politically correct line and denounce all things racist or, you know, supposedly racist. And still, though, it wasn't enough to save her because they pretended to be racist in the movie denouncing racism, and even pretending to be racist is enough to get you fired. Whatever racist is, of course, the word means.
You have to check with the fearless leader, Abe Foxman, first before you dare to get into any type of area where you might possibly run afoul of political correctness. Remember, Ku Klux Klan, white robes, Nazi, Jew, Holocaust. Don't go there without checking with Abe Foxman first.
You can't use the word in any context whatsoever.
Yeah.
Unless you have his express written permission on a notarized...
Neo-Nazi. Throw that one in there, too.
Letter. Yeah, neo-Nazi, anti-Semite, white supremacist. What am I missing here?
Klansmen, let's see.
All of them. They've got trademarks on those words. They are the only ones who can brandy them about. They are the only ones who can label people as such. Other people can't dare think about doing the same.
No.
That's the way the world is turning right now, but we're doing our best for the political cesspool to make sure that we rewind the time and get it back to a free and God-fearing republic. And we're going to continue to do that in the second hour when we return right after this. Thank you, Keith Alexander. See you next week.
Thank you, James.
Stay tuned. Hour number two of the political cesspool comes your way right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and says, something's got a hold on me. The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting, hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of the looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.